Hello, my fellow ocean lovers. I am Ellen Spooner, a marine biologist and science storyteller, and this is the Ocean Optimism Podcast, a show where we hear the untold and not often shared stories of ocean conservation successes and solutions. Time and again, we see the greatest challenges lead to the greatest opportunities. So dive in with me as I interview scientists, activists, and leaders to explore the incredible feats already underway to take care of our ocean. Hello, all of my fellow ocean lovers. I am so excited because today we get to talk to Mark Chavez, who is the founder of the organization Native Like Water. Native Like Water prepares and reintegrates teens and adults into ocean recreation, conservation, wellness, and intergenerational cultural self-exploration. The program focuses on Indigenous sacred relations to water and creates a scholarship and support for endangered Native American populations in California and internationally. Thank you so much for coming on, Mark.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate this.
So the first question I wanted to ask was to hear a little bit about your background and what inspired you to start this organization, Native Like Water.
Okay. Well, my background, I graduated from UC San Diego in the early 90s, like 94. Prior to that, I grew up in Los Angeles, and at one time I was a high school dropout, and I kind of had suffered just some violence in the streets and stuff. But then I got it together finally, and I went to community college in LA, and then came to UCSD, and I graduated with honors there on the dean's list, so that was pretty cool. So I kind of made that little turnaround. And something that I think helped save my life was surfing and being around the ocean. Growing up, I wasn't in close proximity to the ocean, but we lived in the San Gabriel Valley, which is like an hour from the sea. So it was something that I didn't grow up with, but I always was kind of drawn to it. There was like this inner feeling that I had, like, that I really wanted to be, like, I would probably, my biggest yearning I can remember was if I could live near the ocean, you know. It's like, and I guess a lot of people have that, but I remember we would go to the beach with my parents maybe once or twice, maybe more, twice a year or so, and we would go, and it was just one of the greatest things. I just always just dreamt of living next on the coast. When I got out of high school, I started to drive, and I had a car, so I was able to drive myself to the beach. I started to surf. So, you know, that was, I guess, the beginning with my more of an intimate relationship with the ocean. And I remember, you know, kind of going down to Trestles and San Onofre and touching slimy rocks and seaweed with my feet for the first time, and how scary that felt. So it was, you know, it was an acclimation for sure. But it was the starting of a relationship, you know, with the ocean. And it's Native Like Water. I started this program in 2000, and I started bringing young folks from the local reservations of San Diego and across the state. And we would bring them to La Jolla to have a 2-week a kind of immersion academic wellness program, and surfing was just like a component of it. We did it probably twice during the 2 weeks that we were together. It was a residential program, so we did a lot of, you know, science stuff and cultural things and a lot of academic stuff, and just getting them used to what it feels like to be at the university. So that was kind of the main thing of it. But, you know, I was always kind of ashamed, not ashamed, but a little bashful, I guess you could say, about the fact that I surfed, because coming from, you know, communities of color, I guess you could say, excluding, not talking about Hawaii, but growing up in California, you know, if you're trying to surf or whatever, it was like you were trying to be part of like a white culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was a little, I had like a little stigma, I guess you could say, and I was a little ashamed of that whole situation that I surfed, but I knew it was something so important and so great that I decided to have our program with the teenagers at La Jolla and right there around SIO and Scripps, just so they can feel what that feels like to be on the ocean. Cause it was like the things that I yearned for, I wanted to give them. And particularly those areas around La Jolla, you know, our village sites and ancient burial grounds and just, you know, places of high importance to the culture locally that people kind of forget about. So trying to again, reintroduce our young people to those coastal environments and just having the programs in La Jolla was great. But then actually to get them involved and interactive with the ocean. So surfing became a small part of the program that, 20 something years later, everybody still remembers if they were in the program. If you ask them, what was your favorite part of that? They always say surfing and, you know, it was the greatest. And even though we did so many cool things and we got rave reviews over everything we did, the surfing always stood out in everybody's mind. And in 2014, we got an invitation to go to Hawaii by one of our mentors, Cliff Capono, who graduated from UCSD as well, and who does wonderful work within the ocean and sciences. He'd be a good guy to have as a guest on this. Anyway, he's a professional surfer, and he got his PhD studying coral reefs and all kinds of other stuff. So he invited us out to Hawaii. He says, you know, this program is really cool. It would be great if you could share it with the Hawaiians. They would really use like this. And mm-hmm. I was like, wow. So it was a kind of an invitation, and we went out to Hawaii and out to Oahu, and that started kind of a very much a higher education on ocean going cultures. So the reason why we were probably brought out there is just because, not because I knew a lot of stuff about the ocean, but necessarily because of our dynamic of the program, mixing the culture and academics and stuff. So we would go out there, and the stuff that we were introduced to by basically, you know, the gurus of ocean culture was amazing. We got introduced to the Hokulea, which is a traditional Hawaiian voyaging canoe that uses the stars to navigate. We got introduced to, you know, some of the best ocean safety folks in the world. Some of the greatest surfers in the world. You know, we got introduced to just this huge amount of ocean knowledge that started just from this invitation when we started going there in 2014. And that's when I kind of tagged the moniker of Native Like Water right before we went out to Hawaii, because we were going under another moniker of Intertribal Youth. And every so often I always like to kind of not reinvent myself, but kind of just refocus on what it is that we're here to do.
Mm-hmm.
And Intertribal Youth was really cool because we were serving, you know, teenagers for the most part for, you know, a good 15 years. And I wanted to focus on what was the most important thing that I think that we needed to really focus on or have a mantra about. And I really felt it was the water. It was really understanding our relationship to the water.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing, you know, that we're over 70% water as human beings, we're mostly water, kind of like the planet, you know, we're mostly water. We have a lot in common there. And what does that mean? You know, once we kind of understand that, what does that mean? And then, you know, later, the following couple of years, the whole fight at Standing Rock over the Keystone Pipeline, all kinds of things were happening out there, you know, and created this movement of water protectors.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of really, you know, I saw such beauty in that. And then I also started to see some things that we could probably work on, which we all should do. And that was, again, focusing on our own water within our own bodies and our own health.
Mm-hmm.
So we understand that polluting the ocean and understand polluting the rivers and the lakes is a bad thing. And how can we look at ourselves and apply those same types of principles of eating correctly or not putting, you know, hot Cheetos in our bodies, which we wouldn't just throw a bag of hot Cheetos into the river, you know, or to a pool of water, because mm-hmm. it would just create all kinds of mess. And that's, you know, for us, the wellness side has always been part of our program. So I felt Native Like Water really started to kind of ask the question of, like, you know, how are we seeing ourselves? How can we treat ourselves better? How can we meditate on the water that we have inside and treat it a lot better? And then see the reflection in each other, you know, and see how with this reflection in each other, water has so many different metaphors. And also it spoke to the nature and spirit of our program, which was, you know, find a way to make it happen. You know, water continues to flow. It finds that way, that exit, or that way to just continue. So, you know, I like to say, you know, many, all of our kind of water droplets getting together, you know, to create one sea. So it just had so much beauty to it. And, you know, there's a lot to be said in what's in a name. And also for non-Native people to kind of understand who we were and what we did. Because, you know, there's still a lot of resistance, I guess you could say, in regards to, you know, accepting Indigenous people in these lands. Mm-hmm. And when I say a lot of resistance, I mean, you know, there's folks who might not want to own up to, you know, the history of maybe what their ancestors did. Mm-hmm. Maybe the inequality that still exists based on, you know, downright, you know, very bad things that took place. Mm-hmm. So the Native Like Water also strips it down to, you know, who we kind of are. Like, mm-hmm. we're as Native as water is, you know, or as Native as these Native species are, you know. And that's kind of where I feel like I continue a conversation in regards to who we are. And when, especially within the environmental movement, I see that there's still, you know, so much more room for improvement mm-hmm. when it comes to that type of equity or that types of thinking, you know, where we spent, I don't know, the first 20 years of this environment. I don't know when the environmental movement, I guess you could say, was founded. Let's just say the first Earth Day in the 70s or whatever it was, mm-hmm. Where we all got back that we need to save the planet. We all started to save whales and save dolphins, or even make laws that can put people in jail for, you know, harvesting lobsters or cutting down a certain tree or whatever. Or look at the Torrey Pines, for example. There's a reserve sitting there on the coast. Those trees are as ancient as the cultures that came before it. Yet mm-hmm. the Native Indigenous people do not benefit from those types of perspectives, in the sense that when we're here to replant trees or Native species or reintroduce Native species, what about the human element? What about that human aspect?
Yeah.
And speaking to that, I think we could help with our allies thinking, you know, thinking beyond just, okay, you know, the just plant trees or just save the whales. Like, what about the original people? How can we be really full in what we're doing?
Yes.
You know, and how we're looking at this, what do you call it, you know, reformation or restoration, this restorative justice, this environmental restoration.
Environmental justice.
It goes hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
It goes hand in hand.
Yeah.
So, so that's a little bit about, you know, kind of where we are, what we do. And a lot of it is interesting because it's my story as well. You know, this story of bringing back young people to the sea, you know, my background, from my maternal side is Nahuatl, which is Indigenous Mexican mostly from the central part of Mexico. And I didn't even know my origins, so to speak, my coastal origins up until like 6 years ago. And this is after I've been running my program for so many years, trying to get everybody back to the coast. And then finally I go back to Mexico and realize through just straight intuition and that, you know, finding my family that actually are from the coast, which I had no idea, you know, next to some of the most greatest waves in the world, right on the coast. And I was like, wow, this is where I'm from. So it was interesting to see that for so many years, I was having this great effort and triumph, I guess you could say, in bringing the local indigenous young people to the sea in California. And to realize that was like a real deeper yearning that I would ever know, that it was really for me. And that actually had some reality in it. You know, it was pretty amazing.
Wow. That is really incredible that your effort to bring young people to the coast came full circle to you learning about your origins and your cultural background of also coming from the coast. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about the indigenous tribes here in San Diego and some of their cultural connections to the ocean, and maybe some of the practices that they have to stay connected to the ocean, like you were saying, and help take care of it, and how it's mutually beneficial, and how your program works with that as well.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, you know, I'm not the expert on culture in San Diego. You know, it's a great thing that we do have a few folks out there that I can call on to help kind of piece this back together. And when I say piece this back together, one of our teachers and probably our leading cultural expert within the coastal cultural I guess genre right now is Dr. Stan Rodriguez. And you know, in one of his interviews a few years ago, he says we're kind of like a clay pot. We're kind of like in shards, you know, and we're kind of piecing our story back together. And I feel like that's exactly what it is that we're doing. So there's a lot of information I could say that we are in the process of learning, in the process of investigating. And of course, there's the greatest thing that exists today is the oral tradition within the community, within the what they call the bird songs. So there's a lot of stories that are passed down through oral tradition and through bird songs that still exist that give us, I guess you could say, the foundation for the cultural scenario pre-Columbus. And within that, I think we can find a lot of stuff. However, the practice of these things are, I guess you could say, are being reborn. And I like to think that I'm part of that movement. Definitely Stan is a leader in that, with a sense of the practice of creating, you know, the watercraft that was used on the water or in the ocean to recreate the types of instruments that were used to fish. So in regards to cultural practice, you know, there is a handful of folks out there doing stuff, you know, a very small handful in comparison to like Northern California around the Klamath River or around the ocean up there, which is wasn't bombarded, so to speak, by the city, and the removal wasn't as severe as it was in Southern California. You see a greater continuity in practice. In Southern California, there was a break in continuity, of course, with the Spanish, and later a lot of the relocation that took place by pushing people out of the coastal areas. So I guess you could say that there is a big gap, and what we were trying to do is close that by trying to pay attention to these stories that Stan and these bird songs bring, by trying to support activities that just bring us to the ocean. So when I started in 2000, you know, again, this stuff wasn't very prevalent. If you could find like maybe two or three people that were doing stuff, like we would touch in with the Ohachiman folks, which are in the Orange County area. they stayed kind of close to the coast, and there were some cultural practitioners that continued. So we would tap into their stories, to their Grunion run stories, their activities. But now in San Diego, you know, Stan's going to have a Grunion run right now in July 16th in Ocean Beach. And so it's a movement that's starting to take foot, I guess you could say. In my thing, it was always just like, let's just get us to the beach, and see what takes place. Mm-hmm. And if you can imagine, like, you know, your culture, somehow somebody performs a lobotomy on it or, you know, damages it in such a way where there could be this whole like forgetting involved. Mm-hmm. This. So what would you do? Well, you would probably start by bringing the people just to the coastline and to the water and see what types of feelings take place. Mm. What types of innate memory could start to resurface from their DNA, or maybe just the smell of the salt water, or the sound of the waves, or just the sound of that ocean, or put them in the water and then see what takes place. And sometimes you would think, well, just beauty would happen because we all love to be in the water, but sometimes there's trauma that exists. A lot of people in the whole situation of annihilation and massacre, you know, ran to the water to try to escape. So sometimes there's trauma, but a lot of times there's this reconnection that's super beautiful. To be floating on the ocean on a surfboard or in a canoe or in a tule boat, like this whole story can come back to a person. They say DNA has memory, and mm-hmm. they also know that water has memory. Mm-hmm. So if the DNA and the water and, you know, who we are has that type of power or possibility, then the opportunity just to bring us to the coast, what can take place? And so a lot of, for me, has just been that. Of course, I bring, you know, folks, cultural folks in and different types of things. And yeah, we study a little bit of ocean science, or get acquainted with what's going down. And then within that mixture of scientists like you or your counterparts of oral tradition or of just innate feelings, and starting to mix that up into maybe one room or a conversation. You know, these scientists who've been making these observations for over numbers of years based on their work or their research, this is a whole side or perspective they may not have thought about before. Mm-hmm. You know, again, keying in the observations or cultural practices or even feelings, for that matter, of Indigenous people that have been or that are part of a descendancy of a people that have been there for 10 to 20,000 years. Mm-hmm. So if, you know, if you are a scientist and you base everything that you do on observations and, you know, just, you know, watching data, it's beneficial to the science community to include people in that in whichever way, you know, and yes. Sometimes it's not as obvious right away, but again, my whole thing was just to bring people there and see what takes place. Again, this doesn't happen normally. So it's, and I don't know what it's called in scientific jargon of, you know, how, what that means when you just put people in a place and just see what takes place. But, you know, for me, that was like the biggest thing. And to see over these 20 years, seeing how folks are touched, how these emotions are moved. Mm-hmm. How now that they have children themselves and they are returning to whether it be Scripps Beach or La Jolla Shores or the Cove with their families and having fire and with their families there, that's kind of the reintroduction. Mm-hmm. That's the reintroduction of the native species, you know, making it comfortable so they can be back. And if you've ever, you know, when you study the reintroduction to any native species, you know, there first has to be an area where they can feel comfortable, they can feel mm-hmm. safe to be there. They can spend time there, whether that be a bird or an animal or a flower, that they have that space to grow. And it's something that's not necessarily always available in these mm-hmm. high affluent areas like La Jolla or these coastal areas. So what do we have to do to make that extra effort as a community, as allies. Mm-hmm. You know, you could see what happened in, or what's happening in the North Shore of Oahu, where you're having just to just fence off stuff just to try to keep local plants going so they can hold the soil or hold the sand together. Mm-hmm. You know, these are things that reserves, I guess you could say, or set off space where we could be, or the gatekeepers for that matter can allow that space, not mm-hmm. just for the Torrey Pines, but for us as people to be able to have space where we feel comfortable, where we can practice our traditions. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'll stop right now with one more little thing. You know, we have the bird singers that come down. These bird singers are, you know, sing these songs that are thousands of years old. And one of the lead bird singers came to me, goes, "Mark, you know, I always love coming down to the beach and sharing these songs. And I shared a song tonight." He told me that this is the first time I've sung this song with my grandfather and my father since I was a little kid. But this, and the song talks about being on the water's edge and at the beach, overlooking the water, singing. And he goes, "This is the first time I've actually did it."
Wow.
So they've been singing this song, but inland or at the desert or the high desert. And he goes, "This is the first time I actually sung and I really kind of got it, you know?"
Yeah.
And so that's the power of opening up this access. Yes. Back to the ocean and just putting us there. Like, he wouldn't have been there, his kids wouldn't have been there at the program, or we didn't invite him over. He could have continued singing that song up on the, you know, in the high desert. But the fact that we can put our feet in the our toes in the sand and maybe in the water, you know, it's the access is super important. And it's not just important for us as people, as for the Native community, but I think it's important what that type of information or mind power opens up for all of us that are enjoying the coast. We all can benefit from this types of knowledge and this type of insight, especially if we're all on the same page with trying to you know, detour a lot of this, you know, climate tragedy that's supposed to be, you know, happening.
Yes. Wow. I think that is such an incredible story of how you are helping to address the centuries long ago issue of colonization and the horrible, horrible things that happened to the Native people in this area, and how you said they were separated from the coastline, and the loss of knowledge and culture. And one way of bringing that back is simply just bringing Native people to the ocean and seeing what comes from that, I think is so beautiful. And I was wondering, you mentioned there's an event happening in Ocean Beach with the Grunion. Could you explain a little bit more about what that is?
Well, Stan Rodriguez, who is a teacher at KCC and who also got his PhD at UC San Diego, KCC is Kumeyaay Community College based out of Sequan. He is having it's the Grunion Run. So all the Grunions are coming up on the beach and they do like a harvest. So it's a certain time of year when the Grunions come and they usually kind of harvest. I think there's certain limitations to that or laws probably with California how you can harvest Grunion, but I think they're just going to do it like by hand or whatever, but it's a tradition, it's a cultural thing. So on July 16th they're meeting down at Ocean Beach. I don't have all the information right here with me, but it's pretty much they're meeting at Ocean Beach. I'm not sure exactly what part of Ocean Beach, but I definitely get that information and send it off to you.
Wow. I mean, that's just to me, like one small example of some of the amazing work that it sounds like you guys are doing to, like you said, bring your like natives back to the coastline. And it's incredible to hear these stories like you shared of the person who sings the bird songs and how this was the first time where they actually sang it in front of the water. I don't know if you have, like, I mean, you shared your personal story, but if you have other examples of how this program has really helped impact people's lives and reintegrated natives back to the coastline.
Well, you know, there's different pathways to, I think, to leadership and to making a change in the world. So, you know, some of them have gone on to be students at UCSD or the universities. That's something that everybody kind of wants, you know, in the beginning, of course, is get your education, pursue higher education. But in reality, only like less than 1%. This meeting has been upgraded by the whole. Less than 1% of folks end up going to the university, you know, so where's everybody else? So there's another group of folks that just become parents and just good parents and good community members and good family members. And so as far as how it's impacted their life, some of it has been like, okay, yeah, we went and pursued an education. We're on this path now. Some of us are like, oh, this is the first time we ever traveled. Some folks get off the rest, some don't. So some of them just to leave their comfort zone and to come to the coast is a great thing. Or, you know, what we always have is we have travel opportunities. So for them to like even leave the county, the state, the country, mm-hmm. and to mix it up with other Indigenous people that they might have never thought of. Mm-hmm. So there's Indigenous people that exist in Southern California that, you know, people don't even know exist. Mm-hmm. And then there's Indigenous people that don't know other Indigenous people exist. Because it's all just, you know, hush and quiet because the mainstream media or the main dominant narrative does not include us most of the time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's kind of getting to know one another. It's getting to know yourself. And that's the whole Native Like Water thing. So making that impact, you know, within the community as just a good person, knowing that other things exist. Right now, you know, there's so many. There's such a big spectrum when it comes to, you know, ocean knowledge. Ocean is so vast, you know, there's so much, mm-hmm. so much. And it's like a big canvas and anybody can probably just go and paint on, which is nice. It's, you know, it's open access to folks once they get to the water, you know, based on, you know, they could be paraplegic. They could be suffering from, you know, some serious mental health, but it's all a spot where they can just go be in, you know. It could be a calm water, it could be waves. Waves create a lot of energy, so it's something that's just super powerful and such a great opportunity. But there's so many things to do, you know. But one of the things that we have been focusing on this last year has been the surfing aspect of it, mm-hmm. and surf therapy. Surf therapy is now, you know, research backed as far as it's been studied to and the wide application it has on so much different things, especially mental health, mm-hmm. is incredible. You know, it's like drug free. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of stuff that how we can interact with the ocean, you know, as scientists, whether we go on a research vessel or go scuba diving or whatnot. But you know, those usually all take, you know, some motivate, you know, a higher education or a higher pathway or a motivated person to go find out even what these classes are, or who does it. But with the surfing, it's nice because you can just put folks in, you know, boom.
Yeah.
And they have a return. Because again, you know, that instant gratification is still like key. With that comes a responsibility of safety, of course. And that's something also that we have to be parallel with. So it's not just surfing; it's trying to be updated with the best safety knowledge, or all, you know. And that's a whole thing within itself. The ocean is constantly changing. It's like trying to go in and grab a bull by its horns sometimes. So it's not always just an easy thing. Sometimes it's just stay out of the bull ring. But these are things that a lot of folks, when we're introducing or trying to have a culture of water going, ocean going culture, we have to take into account, mm-hmm. because it's not, oh, you just don't bring all these people who don't know what's up and just throw them in the water. Mm-hmm. So it's a delicate thing. you know, which is kind of cool in a way, where in a sense that it makes you be more alert, more sensitive to other people's limitations or your own limitation. It confronts fear, where you have to go through that wall of fear, because all most of it's based in your head. There's a lot of limitations that are based in our head, probably most of them. But then there's, of course, the limitations of the ocean or weather patterns or things of that nature. But for the most part, the big limitations are in our head, or limited knowledge. And this is something that we found, the fact that we're in surfing more, is we had the opportunity from our uncles out in Hawaii that began, you know, this great course called the Big Wave Risk Assessment Group. Started off for big wave riders, but the big wave riders looked to these Hawaiian uncles for their ocean safety education. So these Hawaiian uncles, you know, and the big wave rider surfers, you know, began this course to address, you know, these severe conditions that they go out in, and they've lost a couple lives, you know. So they to address that. But what's so nice about it is that this education that they're learning for themselves, you know, the big wave surfers are a very small community kind of group of people out there. It's, as you can say, it's like a tiny little cult in a sense, because they're all just, you know, you know, they kind of know each other. It's a super severe thing. You can't go fake it. You got to be super dedicated to it. Always putting time into it. You know, practice breathing, practice first aid, know how to ride a, you know, just so many stuff. But anyway, the fact that they did it, and it's applicable to us as ocean lovers, that I feel like everybody, whether you surf or don't surf, should learn how to read the ocean. Because again, you know, storytelling and a lot of these things have a great impact on us, and in a learning sense. And the ocean, for all that it represents, and it's all its moods, and it's all its masses and flowing and different beaches and different, you know, bottoms and temperatures and, you know, reflection of the sky. Within all of this comes all life, any life lesson that we could think of. And especially not just a life lesson, but when you're working in the situation, in the type of situation that we work in our community, it's always a state of emergency. We've been living in a state of emergency since those colonists got here. And what does that mean when you're in a state of emergency? That says like, whoa, fuck, you know, like, wow, what does that mean? Well, that's a pretty stressful situation. You know, if I had to tell you, if I had to say, yo, check it out, for the next 5 years, you're going to be living in a state of emergency. And some of us are maybe feeling like that in our own lives. You don't have to be native. You can be anybody. But I'm just letting you know that with that, since we were fighting for survival, and I was saying the ocean has so many life lessons, or all life, all metaphors to life, that, you know, for a person, for people who are in a state of emergency, it's one of the greatest teachers. So if you could work on safety in the ocean, or just life preservation within the ocean, because you deal with it on a daily basis as a surfer or even as a, you know, diver or whatnot, you can apply that to what happens in the state of emergency when it's a life or death situation. State emergencies are life or death situations. And in our communities, we're losing life at such a rapid rate that it's like 911 all the time. You know what I mean? And that's just with folks, you know, dying of diseases based on their health. Then there's, you know, the people killing each other. Then there's the people killing themselves based on drugs. So this is such a commonality that if anybody has ever done work with people of color or folks from different barrios or ghettos or slums or whatever, you walk into onto a reservation and it looks like, you know, open skies and just beautiful terrain, and you find like shit's serious, you know. And so in that type of community, I like to, you know, I normally don't even make the point of talking about that, but I like to folks to understand that, you know, it's not all just romantic, you know what I mean? What we're dealing with is out of necessity, because we're trying to stay alive. So when I say surfing, you know, found me or whatever, or surfing saved my life, I'm talking about within a state of emergency of life or death, something came to my rescue. So if these are metaphorical life rafts or a helping hand from God, that this is what we're dealing with. We're looking for that instrument, that tool, that idea, that whatever that could save somebody's life. And we have to use it like we got 5 seconds to get in on the end. And then we got 60 seconds, you know, until somebody's already, you know, panicked and passed out. And so it's a metaphor across the way. So, you know, one of the things studying from the Hawaiian uncles, water safety and ocean knowledge, was this stuff is like the best thing I could do to go increase my skill or knowledge in helping my own community or helping myself first by staying alive. Like my shit goes bad, it gets heavy, COVID, whatever, you know, if I don't get to the ocean, shit can go bad for me. You know what I mean? And so, and then not to mention everything else that happened in my life or trauma or whatnot. So, you know, out of the COVID piece that we had these last couple of years, out of that came our coastal distancing program, which is down here in Mexico, which has this huge beach with nobody at it, with plenty of waves, warm water, you know, blue skies. So we started that because we just need like a huge playground. We need a huge space to be us. Not just a playground. I don't know if you saw this video the other day. It was on TikTok or some stuff. This Karen or whatever, you know, they call Karen. Like this Karen was at the park. Was at this park trying to tell the kids to not scream when they're playing. And this Karen was telling the parents over the fence, you know, because, you know, parks have these like wall fences. So she was screaming over the fence at the parent or the teacher or whoever it was, that they can't scream while they're playing. And they're on a playground, like in the middle of the day. And we're just, you know, it's just like, I don't know what, you know, we need that space to be us. Comes back to that. You know what I mean? And when you're cruising La Jolla with 40 native Indians, you know, there's a lot of people looking over their shoulder doing the Karen. Like, why are these guys here? Are they supposed to be here? You know what I mean? This is a private neighborhood, you know what I mean, or whatever. This is a private beach, so we need space to be us. And what we did is we found, you know, being here in Mexico on in my maternal homeland, on having these access to these beaches and these places that look just like La Jolla and La Jolla shores, but are in warmer climate, you know, and still owned and run by the native people. We went even deeper, you know. I think that would be our wildest dream, is that yes, we would have a reserve the size of Torrey Pines at least, that we could just go be free at and harvest abalone, harvest lobster, and catch some waves. But you know, I think we're on the brink of that. We're at the tip, you know, of the iceberg. But this is, I think, where we're headed, is just to be us. And I use the analogy of the kids and the Karen, because at the end of the day, we're all just little kids. This is what's so crappy about the whole thing. Someone went and effed up, and really effed up shit. And the conversation where environmentalism needs to start is, when was the first disrespect done to the native species? Can you tell me? Was it because the boat pulled up on shore and the guy walked out and stepped on a plant that was close to extinct? No, it wasn't. It was between humans getting eradicated. And so it's a big thing with environmentalism or whatever, is shifting the narrative. Is you, any situation you go to in an environment in a state of emergency where you have critically endangered species within that environment, your big thing is what? Eradicate the non-native species that's choking folks out and reintroduce the native species. And that's just a principle. Now, that might seem kind of weird for people. I'm not saying go have a revolution and yank everybody out of La Jolla. I'm just saying, like, what I'm saying is we need space.
Yeah.
Where we can, where maybe the intrusive folks or the folks that got out of hand and strangled a bunch of native species out, they need to maybe just back off, you know, and give us a little space.
Yeah.
Find some space. But at least in your mind, what do you know when I'm telling you about this? And then within the environmental movement, so for some of our allies, we could think of that in our heads. We can grasp that.
Yeah.
We can say, oh, hey, yeah, we need a reserve. Or, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, the reserve ain't the thing. We all want to share space. We all want to share land. We're all Americans and whatnot. Is that we want to share space, but still, like, how can we hold space and circle more where we can just maybe have some little bit more, even if it's just silence, that we're just listening.
Yeah.
In that circle, in that piece of land, as scientists, we're usually in environments, right? We're outside, or mm-hmm. a lot of us are in the lab, but I'm talking about the ones who are, you know, doing field work and most do. So the ones that are out there, you know, is holding that silence. And we do already, a lot of us are loners. That's why we pick the jobs that we have to be, you know, out in the field scientists or whatever, but and awkward and weird, you know, bad social skills, you know, not all scientists, but like, you know, we're little groups and clusters for a reason, and we're doing it. And we're just all the same metaphor. We're all just little kids mm-hmm. that want to have a playground, be amazed and in awe.
Mm-hmm.
And if some shit happens, we scream and we scream and we scream and we laugh and we laugh and we laugh and we can cook over the open fire. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's just back to basics. It's like there should be no mystery on how to just move forward.
Mm.
But like I said, if you write those analogies with the children, also with eradicating invasive species, is like, what does that mean? Like, how do we do that properly without, if we do apply that to the human aspect, and we do apply it to knowledge that the first disrespect was with that human contact, and we had to eradicate the, how would that look? Like I said, it can't be extreme. It can't, like, we could just get rid of everybody. Mm. So there has to be a cohabitation situation.
Mm-hmm.
That we all need to be working on, I think. You know, I think mm-hmm. that should be a principle. And I think every gathering and every discipline within any particular geographical area should be stopping and thinking about that. And even if it's just silence, maybe they don't have nobody to turn to bring up that stuff. You could just say it yourself and say, listen, you know what I mean? Because we get a lot of calls for what they call land acknowledgments now. Or, you know, blessings or whatever, because it became something that we asked for. We became something that we all wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is now we all get calls to do it, but it's like, we don't have to go and do it all the time. You could do it yourself. There's not enough of us to go around.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know what I mean? And for me in San Diego, I can't go and acknowledge San Diego. I have to call an elder. I have to have somebody come out for 5 minutes and shoot some truth. But that's like becomes very laborious because mm-hmm. there's only so many. Remember, we're an endangered community. Mm-hmm. The numbers are small. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's one of those things that we can all hold space and circle. Maybe you can't call in the elder or the person, the cultural person. Just hold some freaking silence, like 5 minutes or 2 minutes, and just see what comes out of that. Maybe some people come up and talk about what they do know. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? But what I'm saying is every discipline, every gathering, every situation should be having this just as a backdrop,
mm-hmm.
just like air in the room, just like oxygen in the room. We should all be breathing this, thinking about this, because again, it's beneficial to all of us, not mm-hmm. because you have to come give us some big props. It's just because it's beneficial to all of us.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I'm really glad that you said that, because one of the things that I wanted to ask you is, what can a regular person do to help address some of these challenges? So I feel like that is one perfect example. And I just wanted to touch on what you had said earlier about safety in the ocean and the waves being lessons for life. I myself just started surfing a little over a year ago, and totally like noticed those metaphors that you were mentioning just myself in surfing, because like just paddling past the break, like when the waves are pounding and you're trying to get past them so that you can have a relaxing moment, you have to just keep going. And I thought just to myself about how that is a metaphor for life. So I think it's really cool that you brought that up. And then one other thing that you had mentioned, I wanted to ask you a little bit more, is you said you feel that you guys are on the brink of getting space on the coastline. And so I was wondering what makes you optimistic about the future of the ocean and that connection, you know, and talk a little bit more about that brink that you were mentioning earlier.
Well, there's two roads to that. There's just like two parallels. It's first is like, yes, physical space. Wouldn't it be nice if we did get physical space allotted to us? And it even sounds funny even just saying that, because here you have, again, the indigenous people. So just imagine, I like to tell people to imagine like a dolphin is talking, or these couple birds that are like indigenous and they're like super endangered. And they're just talking to each other going like, wouldn't it be great if we just had a little bit of space? If they gave us back a little bit of what they took. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? We're not asking for like the whole San Diego County. We're just looking, you know, wouldn't it be great? We can have our little storage area. We can put our boats and we can put our boards. Wouldn't it be just great? That's how we talk in a kind way. In the other side of things, it's, first of all, that can't hold us back from just showing up.
Mm-hmm.
Showing up to the natural spaces that are already open. And this is something that I talk to quite a bit on, because a lot of people have the fantasy of owning land or taking back land. And land is a situation that, if you've ever had to caretake land that was over an acre or even, you know how challenging it can be, you know, and it's something to caretake land is something, it's a beautiful thing. And I think indigenous people have done it the best in our around the world, as you see from the ancient cultures, that it was, you know, it's, we are humbled by that. It does its own thing. We're just there to like, you know, kind of just, when we say caretake, we're just kind of like ushers. We're just like, we're not even the main act. We're just like, make sure everybody gets to their seats and enjoys the show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we just make sure the pathways are clean, make sure, you know, the water systems are good. And so when you have a big farm or whatever, those are the kind of the main things. If you don't have a bunch of livestock or animals, you're just trying to let it grow and be itself.
Mm-hmm.
So it's what I say, what I talk to on this sometimes, because sometimes it's something that people, we have to know. It's like when we call land back, like we want, let's say we want a bunch of land. Is there enough of us to really make action? Like, what are we doing with the land we already got? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of us need to think about that. What are we doing with the land we already got? So what I'm saying is there's two roads is, yeah, we should get the land back. I'm not saying we shouldn't, or even a little piece. But then there's the other side with, what are we doing with the spaces that we have open to us now?
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, it's to empower yourself to, yeah, go to Pacific Beach and go surf. Go to La Jolla and go surf. And know that this is your place.
Mm-hmm.
One of our mentors, Dina, Auntie Dina, who teaches that over at Cal State San Marcos, when I asked her like what she felt indigeneity was, you know, like what does it mean to be Indian? It's just like, it's the space you show up, that space around you is indigenous because it already is before you showed up. But two, because you showed up and you're indigenous to that area, now you just like consummated the real reality. Mm-hmm. And that now that's your indigenous space. She didn't say it like that. I'm saying it like that now that after I've thought about a lot of the stuff she says. But it was just like, it's the space around you. You show up.
Mm-hmm.
You made it indigenous because you walked into the room. Maybe the whole room's not indigenous, but I'm saying is like, you just threw, if this is a recipe and you're an ingredient, you just walked in, you gave it some flavor or whatnot. You know, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
So what I want to say is, you know, we've been in this talk and this thing since they probably took the land, that we want this stuff back, or we want pieces of it, or for the most part, don't go destroy freaking cemeteries.
Yes.
Don't go destroy burial grounds. Start with some respect. Again, we're back to some like real basic stuff.
Yes.
You know, start with that. Start with not trotting on our relatives, on our deceased ones. Have some respect. Then if we can get past that, but they're not even past that. So, you know, once they get past that, you know, when I say they, I mean the people, whoever's holding these chunks of land.
Yeah.
Is that, yeah, let's say like, okay, let's give you the dopest piece because you guys are probably going to do some dope stuff with it. Or give us a crappy piece, whatever. It's all the same. It doesn't matter. You know, when I say crappy piece, meaning maybe it has more mosquitoes, or maybe you shouldn't be putting that thing there because it's not where people should have been. Usually you're going to go back to where people should have been, you know what I mean? Or where they're at now. And again, that's usually the most lucrative for the environment, but also it's the most sensitive because that's where you know, right there in La Jolla Cove, for example, that cove is like, if somebody asked me, okay, where would you like to be put back to? Well, right there. Why? Because there's tons of food there. We're all where the food is. You're going to be all where the food is and where the fresh water is. And before La Jolla Shores, you know, that back area right there was just fresh water. So that's the birth of life. So when we go to creation stories and when our uncles come down and talk creation stories there in La Jolla at the shores and we have our fires, you know, they talk about the creation story right there and then and looking out to sea. So it's actually because, you know, the villages that are out under sea are 10,000 years old, older than the ones on the land. So the land ones are 10,000 years old, and then the out to sea, those villages are another 10,000, that's 20,000 years old. So the creation story, we look out to the ocean and it comes from out there of the villages and the islands that are out there. But in just creation of everyday creation, hopefully there's some marsh still left somewhere in La Jolla there and La Jolla Shores that's connected the fresh water to the salt water. And that's where life is becomes or is, you know, so even if it's not, it was all cemented, we come back. And there we are. That's where we do most of our work, in, you know, between SIO and La Jolla Shores. So the fact that we are there, whether the water's connected, salt water's connected to the fresh water or not, which it still is, because, you know, you can see it dripping off and underneath the earth, you know, there's creeks that run out to sea. So you can't stop this pop-up of life. Even if you cemented it, I mean, we acted like we're going to all, like, you know, mourn over it. And like, if you see the old pictures and everything else, but the thing is that how do you feel empowered like that? You know, how do these little kids, when I go speak at third graders or fourth graders, and they come in, oh, can you come speak on, you know, maybe some solutions to climate change? They don't send me solutions, but they just like, you know, everybody's trying to find some kind of topic to talk about, feel like they're actually doing something or being a part of it. But you go up and these go over to these schools and these fourth graders, dude, they're like stressed with the weight of the world.
Yes. Yes.
Like, does anybody get that part? I'm looking at these guys. It's like, I want to ease their stress. I want to ease their stress. I want to ease all of our stress by saying life is still happening.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, we
need that right now.
Stay motivated?
Yes.
How can we stay motivated? How can we stay optimistic? Because we are there. Thank God. We're still. And those who don't know, come like recognize that we are still there. And not only we're just there hanging out, you know, we're here to thrive.
Yes.
We're here to interact with the water. We're here to get down. And when we're done getting down, we go rest or go study or whatever we're going to do. Mm-hmm. But we're here to get down. And that getting down is again, the laughter and the plays and those screaming that the Karens were worried about was not just screaming because they're like suffering. They're screaming because they're in jubilation.
Mm-hmm.
They're happy.
Mm-hmm.
So we're screaming for joy, and surfing and being around the ocean puts you into the thriving motion. And that particular area, if we want to use it as metaphor, and we're like high scientists, what I call high scientists, meaning is folks that could see from above, see the bigger picture, see the indigenous science within that thing. We're looking at it from above, the high science, through a different lens. That's the indigenous lens. So like, I go from creation to where we're at now in 2020 in endangered species, or 2022 or whatever, is our, we need to just thrive. So you go from a state of emergency. And if you're not in a state of emergency, this is the deal when you're working with communities of color, is like, we've always been in a state of emergency. We've always been in this survival mode. So what the heck are we supposed to do to actually be, to give ourselves enough time to work on some thriving action?
Yeah.
You know, and it's usually just, okay, I'll go to the gym, I'll eat right. That could maybe be the height of it for our community. But then you go to like Encinitas, or you go to La Jolla and you see everybody running around like it's just everyday lifestyle. You're going like, well, geez, I wish everybody from the reservation or from the ghettos or from wherever saw these cats every day. And they're not paying money to run down that beach.
Right.
The fact that they live close, you know, with gasoline prices now is a big division. But, you know, a lot of us can get there, you know, so there's nothing, it doesn't, that's what I found about surfing and around the ocean, is like, it doesn't cost there's not a high admission cost, everything. Every time I go visit family now, it's all like, what can we gather around doing, you know, at a restaurant or out of, or an amusement park. And we're dropping like hundreds of dollars just to hang out together. Just to hang out together. Meanwhile, everybody else is, you know, in this environment, again, where it's free.
Right.
So what are we doing with our spaces that already exist? And I think we should talk to ourselves, ask ourselves about, because we can end up being pretty pissed off and in like some survival mode and in some like even revolutionary mode so hard that it can really mess us up. So it's about that reflection of how can we thrive and keep the water clear?
Yeah.
So getting pissed off and angry, you know, it's easy with what's happening in the Supreme Court and what's happening with the climate. You can get just real pissed, all these little kids, you know, all stressed. So I just had to like tell them, yo, I hate to be like, spoiler alert, but this shit already has happened.
Yes. Yes.
So, and look at, yo, don't be stressing it. It's already happened.
Yeah.
And maybe if you're lucky in your life, you're going to see some rebound.
Yes.
And if not, thrive now. Get your butt out there and go thrive.
Yes.
These little kids, keep playing hard. Go freaking scream. Tell them to F off if they're going to tell you shut up. I mean, you know, sorry to say that, but, you know, a lot of us are rebellious for a reason because we know better.
Yeah.
And you know, we know better. I didn't do good in high school because I knew better. That shit was whacked.
Yeah. Yeah. That is exactly why I wanted to start this Ocean Optimism podcast, because I'm like, we need something to show us that when you take action, it does make a difference. And we have already been through tragedies and already, like, you know, are, like you said, like still here. And there are already people who have solutions and are making a difference. And that's exactly why I wanted to share these stories and talk to more people like you about this. So I'm incredibly thankful for you sharing this message. And you kind of had already talked about this, but I was wondering if there was anything else that you wanted to share of what can an ally do, or what can somebody else do to help further this effort?
That's a good question. You know, I've been really trying to put it together, because in the last 2 years since COVID and everything that's been happening with the police shootings of people, of innocent people, of Black people, of white people, whatever people, but, you know, the stuff that happened by the police and different stuff that's happened by the system. We got a lot of calls, people trying to like wanting to be good allies. And it's something that, again, it's a little burdensome in the sense that now we got to deal with like how we got to go educate everybody.
Mm-hmm.
To be an ally is just like, oh, you just jump in the boat and you never paddled before and shit. You never been in an emergency situation before and shit. You mm-hmm. never dealt with brown people before. You know what I mean? This is like, you guys are, you know what I mean? It's like, we have a learning curve here. And just to jump in on the ally thing is all sounds good. And it's fuzzy to me too. Because maybe you all bring resources, but the thing is that there's a learning curve, and we gotta like start with some cultural sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta look at everything through an indigenous lens. You gotta like take my glasses and start. You know what I mean? We got
mm-hmm.
and that takes. There's a whole thing in that. You mm-hmm. know, it took me a while to start saying, yo, y'all need like we need like a consulting firm. You want to pay? I got some people that I can send that could do that before we become allies and partners,
mm-hmm.
organization to organization. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about statewide organizations. I'm talking about nationally known organizations that are leaders within the environmental world. Everybody be like, bow down if they called you.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But it's just like, y'all, I don't know. You know what I mean? It's like, there's a learning curve in this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know what I mean? It's like, you just started it now because maybe you're going to get press heat from the folks because the system is changing and you need to have some inclusion. But at the same time, there's like, it's more than a manual. And with just knowing that, you're going to have to like, again, kind of step back and be sensitive. I'm not mm-hmm. trying to say just let everybody yield and just people walk over people. I'm mm-hmm. just saying step back. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like this one sister of mine, she's like 30s, in her late 30s. She just got hired for this huge bank in New York City. you know, first time going into like, what do you call it, six digit salaries and all this stuff. And they hired her at this top, you know, senior vice president or whatever thing. And she's in her 30s. And it's just like, she was basically an orphan and poor all her life, living in the projects all her life in the same place.
Mm-hmm.
Just until like recently, like till last year. And mm-hmm. then she gets hired for her ability, but also for the fact that we need inclusion and we need like dope people. Mm-hmm. But she's 100% real. She's a person that didn't compromise who she was in the sense of kind of wild out street knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to say wild out in a bad way. I want to just say wild out as shit needs to be said sometimes with some in a certain way that people just got to like stop and listen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and if the English language is the only thing that we have to try to help you along this learning curve, then y'all need to just like step back and like really listen to what the mm-hmm. heck we're saying. Mm-hmm. And if we say it in a wild out way, you got to be okay with it. Cause like, mm-hmm. remember, we just came from the state of emergency.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this is not to give a pass to everybody. I'm just saying like, you know what I mean? There's in this bridging of equity. And I'm trying to remember what the original question was, but you know, it's for allies.
How can people help? Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, okay, what do we do? Well, we listen. And, you know, when Kelly Slater, the world-class surfer, he opened up a wave pool up in Central California. It's super famous. There's wave pools happening now around the world, but Kelly Slater's wave pool, because it's in California, is, you know, probably one of the most famous. Anyway, they went and put their thing there. And I guess they wanted to have some kind of inauguration or some kind of like, you know, they're a little conscious about aligning, I guess, with the local indigenous community. And the first thing that they say is like, you know what, if you guys want to hang, do some real dope stuff with us or really be on our land, you need to step up and hang out with us at one of our ceremonies or come hang out with us and break bread. You know, it doesn't have to be a big ceremony, but you're going to have to come kick it and kind of just sit and listen. Mm-hmm. And you know what? Guess what? You're probably, there's going to come a time when you're going to be out of your comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be me just talking to you right now, or that could be you in a sweat lodge or you in some area where it's like, you know what? You got to forget all that shit you learned.
Mm-hmm.
The de-learning is like one of the first things.
Mm-hmm.
And then a good ally, I think, is a person who has been able to go and kick it, break bread, or what I like to say is give thanks, mm-hmm. sharing gratitude, AKA pray, you know. Mm-hmm. I think if we weren't on the American soil, what I would say is like, if you're asking what a good ally be done in Europe or around the world, it would be that a Christian goes and hangs out with his Muslim mm-hmm. bro at the mosque, and the Muslim bro goes and hangs out with the Baha'i center with this other heads. And these guys can go ahead and kick it, and the synagogue folks can come out, and everybody can kick it and go check, because they're all there for gratitude. And if they're not, you get checked right away.
Mm-hmm.
You better check yourself. You're part of the problem, yo.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have enough to go to learn about other people and just think like they're all just here for freaking gratitude, that we're trying to just praise the fact that we're alive and that we were given life,
mm-hmm.
and that certain things are sacred that come with the land and with the ways the moon works.
Mm-hmm.
That we all should be fasting maybe at that time.
Mm.
And we should really pay a close attention to these scriptures that are coming from all these spots
mm-hmm.
that are saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Christianity is something that people even to today, or some of us that look like want to blame Christianity for everything, it's like that got robbed at some point too. Mm-hmm. And then they threw it on us, and then we're blaming Christianity. But the original Christianity has earth-based scriptures by earth-based people, by native indigenous people,
mm.
you know, and that moved with the moon cycle.
Mm.
That gave respect to places
mm-hmm.
and also to people that are our prophets
mm-hmm.
that are walking the earth,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's not just Jesus. There's prophets that walk the earth. And if you've got to give gratitude to those cats, because again, where would we be without more direction? So it's really, again, having that respect. If you could tap into that knowledge and you have access to these communities, another thing, you know, we can't be bombarding communities all these requests just to go hang out at a ceremony. But as allies, again, it's maybe just it's smaller things that just need to be done, like I said, by listening. Maybe it's just in a boardroom. Maybe you're never going to leave the boardroom. Maybe you're never going to get a chance to go to the sweat lodge. But if you do and you're a good ally, you'll probably be invited. And if you show sincerity and you show interest, there's a high chance you will be invited because it's for everybody. These aren't necessarily closed things. I mean, some things are, but not close to people who want to give gratitude and want to pray for good stuff, life, life, and an optimism that's connected to a universal practice.
Yes. Yes. Wow. That, I feel like that's a great way to, end this interview. Thank you so much again for sharing all of that information with me. Like I acknowledge myself, I'm on my own learning journey. I watched a lot of the videos on your website to try and educate myself beforehand. And I am forever grateful for you sharing this information with me and how we can be better allies and just hold space and listen. And so even just with this conversation, I feel empowered and excited to help. And I don't know, hopefully some people will listen and feel the same way as well. So thank you so much. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of the Ocean Optimism Podcast. Be sure to tune in to our next Ocean Optimism Podcast, which will be released on Monday, October 24th, where we interview Risa with Paddle for Peace.